Who's starting this out? Are you guys starting this out? Are we talking about bags? What are we doing?
You just started it out. You started out talking about bags, Trent.
I don't think, no, we had a whole conversation going, and now you guys are pretending like we didn't have a whole conversation going. You guys were talking about how much you love Eberle stock bags. It's weird that now you're pretending like you weren't talking about that. Because
never heard of her.
Yeah, Eberle stock. Never heard of her. No, that's a complete and total lie. We've totally heard of her and we love them. So go check out eberlestock.com. Look at all of their stuff from their bags. They've got everyday carry bags. If you got that little SIG Scorpion, if you got that little foldable rifle and you need to conceal carry for some reason, man, they got a bag for you. The Switchblade line is awesome. The Bando is my favorite bag that I can never get my hands on that I'm super upset about. I'm just going to go on when I see them in stock. I'm just going to go on to eberlestock.com. I'm going to get the Bando, and I'm going to use the code OR10, that's OR10, at checkout to get a sweet discount on anything from Eberle Stock. One thing I do want to tell you, check out that technical gear, their line of pants and coats and stuff to protect you in any environment. That stuff is super duper tight. So get you a bag, get you some technical gear, use the code OR10 at checkout over at eberlestock.com.
I think I lied to you in Vegas too, because I ended up with a Bando bag when I came back and I told you that they were all out. So just so you know,
you gave away the last one in Vegas. Yeah. I'm still not past it.
What you should do is probably,
I wasn't supposed to be behind their desk. Yeah. Sorry.
You should just like kind of bulk buy it and then you could start, right, you know, selling it out.
Yeah. Trent was left unsupervised and went behind the counter and started handing out Bando bags.
Hey, see, work do work, you know, like people are still coming in. And they're like, are we supposed to get this stuff? And I'm like, where'd that guy go? Like, yeah, sure. Here's your stuff.
Yeah, he works here, right? Yeah. You know, it's cool. You can fill up those Eberle stock bags with a whole lot of ready to drink hoists and pouches. Like, imagine how many actually in their kind of, oh man, I almost called it a dead something bag. But yeah, I know. I can't say that, right? But you can fit a lot of hoist into their bags. So drinkhoist.com, promo code's one's ready. Great flavors. Love the passion fruit. Love the peach mango. Peach mango is kind of my favorite. That's a jam right there. But they got the raspberry and the fruit punch and watermelon.
Of course it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know.
Peach mango. Get it?
It is good though. Is it not?
I can't believe we haven't thought to do a collaboration with drinkhoist.com to have the peaches mango limited release. That would be great.
Here first. Yeah.
You heard it here first.
Man, there's a bunch of ways to use hoist. It's one of the only things that I can drink intra workout. So when I was rolling last night, it was a tough roll, and I can actually drink this in the middle of a workout. I can't do that with anything else. Like everything else is too sugary. No good. The other thing that I found that I really like is my favorite is the fruit punch, and I'm a packet guy. Like I'm not the pre-mixed dude. So packet gang for life. But in the morning when I'm making my pre-workout, when I'm getting, you know, my multivitamins and stuff in the day, I mix up one of those bad boys and I immediately get ahead of my hydration. So wake up, mix in a hoist, and I'm on the road and off to my workout. So go to drinkhoist.com, use the code ones ready at checkout.
Yeah. Drinks a hoist and tells the world about jujitsu every single time, because you can't go do jujitsu and not talk about it. It's the new CrossFit, everybody.
It has to. Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
How do you know somebody does jujitsu?
Just wait. They'll tell you about it.
They'll tell you about it.
Wow. The ad read that became a roast of Aaron. Tight.
We could do an episode on that. It'd probably go gangbusters too.
Gangbusters.
Anyway, on to the actual real guest that we have, Colonel James Osier, retired, special tactics officer, was a navigator at the beginning of his career. He's got some time at the academy and all that kind of stuff. And actually, helped kind of shape, Colonel Kurt Buller, into who he was in terms of wrestling. So, lots of good nuggets in this. Please enjoy, and, we'll see you later. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Ones Ready podcast. You're in the team room. You've got Aaron, Trent, and myself, as well as Colonel James Osier. Appreciate you joining us today, sir.
My pleasure being here.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have a long career of being a special tactics officer. So I kind of mentioned beforehand, I only kind of know, because I came in 99, I only kind of know the back end or the very tail end of your career as special tactics officer. So I don't even know if you were a STO for your entire career or not. So can you give us a little background about yourself, sir?
Way back, my first school when I was came on active duty was navigator training at Mather Air Force Base, California. I got out, I flew 141s and then rescue 130s. And that's kind of when I got introduced to ground special ops in the Air Force. I'd work out with the PJs every lunchtime, kept my eye on it, but had three, well, I was at the 67th ARRS. From there, I went to USAFE headquarters in Ramstein, and then down to Italy in a command post. When I came back, I got a special duty assignment as the wrestling coach for the Air Force Academy.
And, no way. Yeah. What a cool gig. Got to go to the Springs where they make leaders of America.
Yeah. And just a side note, I recruited and brought Kurt Bullard onto the team.
Oh, wow.
He wrestled for a couple years. And then Kurt, I recruited him as a 118 pounder. In the 2 years he was with us, he never got above 114. And he's going against guys that are cutting weight from 130, 135 down. So they look like giants out there next to him. And it was a tough go for him. He just didn't gain weight. And he went on, did other things that he wanted to do. And then he came into special tactics. And I was with him at the 2-4 that first time that we came together at the same unit. And ended up, we were starting to get into tactical air control, the fast movers, that sort of thing. But we had no representation out there. We had no say in policies or anything else. And they made a position out there for a special tactics officer to be on the cadre. And he was the first one I sent out there.
Oh, wow.
He went out there kicking and screaming, but I'll tell you what, you know, his personality and life is probably the best decision I made as far as getting that position established and operating. And he did it himself, but, and it's paid dividends since then.
Well, I think that kind of set him up for life. You would talk about, you know, he struggled to make weight and that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, he talks very candidly about the struggles. And now I'm kind of confused. And I can't remember if he talked about it in the podcast or if just, you know, knowing us for long and we've talked about it, but the struggles that he had in the pipeline and that kind of stuff. So the struggle's good. Like I love struggle. We need it.
Yeah. It kind of forms you for what you're going to become. And he did talk about it in his podcast a little bit, having to repeat the pipe or the OL, but that's not unusual.
So. No, it's not unusual. You're absolutely right. So, can you take us like what did you always know that you wanted to come in and do? Kind of ground stuff, like was it as a child you always used to play, you know, cowboys and Indians and stuff like that, and then you're like, hey, this opened up and this is exactly what I want to do.
When I was a kid, my dad had cane as a yard plant, and these things get 10-12 feet long. We'd cut them down and we'd use them as spears. And we'd have two teams and we'd run through the neighborhood hiding and ambushing. And then we graduated to BB guns. Yep. And our mothers got really upset with that. And we had to go back to the cane stocks. But yeah.
So did anybody shoot their eye out? Because I've been made aware that you will shoot your eye out if you have a BB gun.
Somebody will shoot your eye out. That's. But
okay, fair enough.
And I grew up on a creek was close by, and I spent all my time down there hunting and fishing, and just basically living outdoors. I got into navigating, and quite honestly, I can do the job, but it never really blew my skirt up. It was boring. And as I, like I mentioned, met the PJs and didn't know much about combat control at that time. And I read an article where they were advertising. I was getting close to where they were going to move me on from the wrestling job. And in their infinite wisdom, it was both. I had a choice between Polk Dice and Little Rock C-130s. And I'm not really excited about it. I read this article about, I'm trying to remember what they called them. Was it crows?
We didn't have crows back then. They were pathfinders in the Air Force. That was the precursors to combat controllers and stuff. We didn't have crows back then. We went through a couple of different name changes. It was at that time, it would be the Air Rescue and Recovery Service. Okay. Was essentially who had the PJs, and they were backenders, and then they were crew members as well. So they were still sitting in the seats of the aircraft to performing an aircrew function. And then, you know, occasionally they would ride the hoist or hop off and go, but those were the early iterations of those guys.
Okay. Yeah. Well, what they were doing, because PJs were an all enlisted career field at that time, and they were introducing officers into it. And the advertisement came out of MAC headquarters, one Colonel Carney, and he advertised for people that wanted to come into that line of work. I had a chance to get on a plane one Friday morning, and it flew to from the academy. We were teaching young cadets how to navigate, and it landed at Scott, and it was going to RON. I jumped off the plane and I ran to MAC headquarters. It was about 4:30 in the afternoon. And I went in, and luckily, Carney's sitting at his desk. I sat down with him and told him, hey, I put in my paperwork. I'd like to cross-train and do this. Well, he had a stack of folders next to him, about 200 deep. He said, yeah, well, just make sure it's in that stack. And never was very receptive. And, you know, you can kind of figure it out. And I said, well, I'm spinning my wheels here. And I went to get up. And before I left, I turned around at the door and I said, you know, you asked for three recommendations. And I know most people send in a one star, two star, three star, four star recommendation. And, you know, they're hoping that the signature block will influence you. I said, I can get that, but I think I've got something better. I've got two guys that you know well that will recommend me. That was the first time he showed interest. And you got to remember, he was an assistant football coach at the Air Force Academy.
Nice.
Yeah. And these guys were there working with him. One was Jack Braley, the strength coach for the football team at that time. The other was Wayne Bachman, the head wrestling coach. And I gave their names, and he looked at me and says, they'll recommend you. And I said, well, as of this morning, they said they would. Sit down. We got to talk this out.
I hope everybody out there is listening to what the colonel is saying.
Yeah.
It does not matter about the process. It matter. Relationships matter. The relationships that you build will do better for you than any single piece of paper in the Air Force. We said it time and time again. And Colonel, I appreciate you bringing that up, but the relationships, those interpersonal relationships that you develop with people, they will get you further in this game than anything else.
Well, you're absolutely right. And we didn't even talk in his office. He looked at his watch and he said, it's happy hour. Let's go to the club.
Let's go.
Went over there, had a few beers. He's talking it out. He knows that air crew, and that's a little tougher, but at least I'm MAC air crew. And they were under MAC. And he said, this is going to take a while, but I'll get you over. It took a year from that meeting till when I got cleared to move on. And he ended up going to the three-star MAC headquarters, who called the two-star at AFMPC and said, hey, you're overmanned in navigators. We're critically undermanned in combat control. And I want to bring this guy over. And the two-star told the three-star he's got it, and I got my orders, And I was able to finish the 1987 season up through Christmas with the wrestling team. And on 1 January of 88, I reported to Fort Benning, Georgia for jump school. And from there, it's just school after school. And the rest is history. So that's how I got in. It was kind of funny. Carney asked me where I wanted to be stationed. I said, well, I'd like to go to McCord or Hurlburt or Pope. He said, oh, well, you're going to Pope.
If you hadn't said Pope, you would have been
you
fine.
Hadn't said it, yeah. Yeah, you never. COA 3 is not supposed to be a real thing, sir. Everybody knows that. There's COA 1, there's COA 2, and then there's a throwaway. You never make the throwaway a possibility. You should have made McCord your throwaway.
Well, I looked at him and said, well, why'd you even ask me if you already knew it before he asked me? He said, well, I was hoping maybe you'd pick Pope and I could meet him. And I thought, okay. Boy, this guy's slick. No wonder.
That's nuanced leadership. That's good.
Yeah. I had the same conversation with somebody one time. They're like, Colorado, Washington, or Pope. And I was like, oh, of course, Colorado or Washington. They're like, okay, cool. You're going to North Carolina.
Yeah.
Like, they're like, everybody wants to go to Colorado and Washington. I'm like, then why do you ask? It's so so ridiculous.
Yeah.
So as you go through this process, the train-up process, how formal was it? Because that's something I'm always interested in is we've talked to a bunch of the guys that kind of went through these things back in the day, and it wasn't total chaos as far as I can tell, but it also was.
They were still trying to get the pipeline established and a schedule and whatnot through the schools. And, of course, with some of these schools, you had to work with the Navy or you had to work with the Army and try to get the right numbers of class slots. There's a lot that goes into it. They were working hard to do it. I went through and, I was actually supposed to go to the OL, but as I started looking at the next year and 2 years and where they wanted me, I didn't have time for 10 weeks on the front end. Right. So they said, okay, we're not going to send you the OL. We're going to send you straight to jump school. So I went to Benning, and the next school after that, they started opening up the fleet schools. I went to Panama City for scuba at the Navy school there. And when I reported in, I made a call back. And the guy that I, they told me that I was going to work for, I was going to be the DO. Colonel Newman was the commander at the 21st at that time. And I had his number. I called him and said, okay, I'm at scuba school. I said, scuba school, what are you doing there? Why'd they do that? I said, well, that was the next thing on the list, I guess. I don't know.
I just do what I'm told.
I just got orders. It's this whole thing. We were going to ask you about airborne school, sir, but it hasn't changed since 1947. So it's exactly the same school. So yeah. No need to ask about that one. Scuba school, I imagine, was different, though.
Yeah, I don't know what it's like now, but he was a little upset. And he really was very supportive in that he said, well, Jim, when you fail out of scuba school, don't worry about it. We'll get you another slot and we'll send you back. You haven't had pre-scuba or anything else. And the attrition on folks that we don't send to pre-scuba is great. And so it's not going to be a mark against you. Don't worry about it. And after I hung up, I thought, when I fail out, geez, I'm only here a week so far. But in my class, there were six guys that had just come out of the OL. And Terry Mackey was the team leader of that group. And every day I asked him, what's the toughest thing you had to do in pre-scuba to be prepared to, you know, pass the test and all that? And he said, probably crossovers. So we would do crossovers every day.
And for those of y'all that don't understand crossovers, let me tell you about the worst thing that was ever invented in the history of mankind. So you have these scuba tanks, and a lot of times the scuba tanks weren't even filled with air. That wasn't good enough. They would fill them with like shot or rocks or like typically like steel bearings, and then they would seal them up, and they were twin 80s. So they were these huge tanks connected by a manifold, sometimes twin 100s. And the idea here was you would hold on to the wall as close as you could to all of your buddies, and they would say go, And then your job was to go subsurface directly down to the bottom of the pool and then swim as close as you can to the bottom of the pool and get to the other side. If there were two people going from opposing sides, one side's a high side, one side's a low side, and you got as close as you could to each other. And you did this basically until five people died. That was the point of the exercise, was for people to never surface ever again. And it was the worst. And by the way, this wasn't the first thing that you did. This was always at the end of a pool session. It was after your tank treads. It was after your ditch and don practice. It was after all these things. So if you've never had the, you know, we talk about alternate water con, and, you know, some of the students are like, oh man, we did 10 ups and there were some crossovers. No, you did not do crossovers. You did something ups. Different. Yeah. You did 10 ups, which it looks the same. It ain't the same, homie. As the kids would say, no cap for real, for real. That is not bussing.
Aaron, stop it. Don't do that.
Sorry. So crossovers, terrifying and awful. So continue, sir. Sorry.
Anyhow, I practiced with Terry. And one of the first things in scuba school, once we hit the pool, was drown proofing. So there are, you know, a bunch of different techniques. Some of them as simple as what you learned at tadpole swimming at the YMCA, how to float, and then progress from there. Well, they put me in the pool and I couldn't float. I'd be on the surface, and next thing you know, my legs are pulling me down, and I'm sitting at 12 feet of water. And they'd bring me out and say, well, you got to relax, blah, blah, blah. They couldn't get me to float. And they said, well, next week we're going into the FAT, the free ascent tower, and it's 50 feet deep. And you go into a cubicle, and you're on compressed air there, and they bring you out at 20 feet, and then give you the signal, and you rise to the surface, learning to control your off-gassing and the like. Then they take you down to 45 feet, and you do the same thing over. I get out at 20 feet. I get the go, and I start sinking. And the instructor's looking at me. And he finally gives me the swim signal, and I swim to the surface. Said, well, some people, 20 feet, they may sink. But at 45, nobody sinks there. And I went down to 45. I came out. Latched onto the cable, get the go, get my hands over my head. And next thing you know, I'm standing on the bottom and I'm not going anywhere. And the guy's looking at me. And it's like he looked at me for 5 minutes. I'm sitting there going, I do have to get to the surface here pretty quick. And so he gives me the swim signal. And I swim to the surface, and he says, in the 10-year history of the FAT, you're the second guy that sank at 45 feet. Everybody else floats up. All I can tell you is if you ever go overboard on a ship, keep swimming like a shark or you're going to drown. Jeez. That was it.
Yeah. So, sir, what was the I'm curious, when you first met up with like some of the other guys that were going through the process and the enlisted folks, like what did that intro sound like? And how did you ingratiate yourself to them, or how did they ingratiate themselves to you as you're going to be like their future boss, or like, cause you guys aren't going through the pipeline together. You just kind of meet up there. Like, how do you recognize each other? And like, what was your first impression of what it was going to be like, you know, in the community based on those guys?
I met those six at Benning. And most of them, except one or two instances, we were pretty much together. School sequences, because after scuba school, we all met up at Air Traffic Control School. Of course, they had their curriculum. Mine was a little different because we got into radar and that sort of thing. And I'd already done the basic survival schools, water, land survival. And with a good number of them, met up at combat control school, the last school. And, you know, when you're in a training pipeline like that, and I got to understand what the OL was designed to prepare you for. You know, I asked for information, and then they were asking me for information. For instance, air traffic control, we talk about it. I'd been a navigator, so I was a little more familiar with air traffic control procedures, letdown plates, just all the things that go with it. And so I'd explain it as best I could to them. So it was a sharing of information. And they all made it through. I made it through. And the final test at Combat Control School was map and compass, 10 clicks, through terrible undergrowth everywhere. And I was big enough. I'd get to a spot, and a lot of these guys would back up, and they'd box around it. And I looked at it and I said, I think I can get through this. And so I'd lower my head, and I'd just start crashing into it. Oh. And finally out the other side and said, I'm going to stay on track here. And but we all made it. And then went off to our different assignments. And I, for some reason, I just thought of one of the guys that was in that group, Eckelstein. I don't know if you knew him, but he was controller. He got out, and I think it was the Suffolk Guard unit. He became a PJ, and they were on a recovery mission, as best I understood what happened, the story. And he ended up drowning on that mission. And
Dave Eckelstein, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
So things happen.
Yeah. Things happen in training and in combat. So it's that's why, you know, attention to detail. That, and you know, for the folks out there, you're going to hear us say, you've heard us say it on this, you're going to hear it in the pipeline, attention to detail, attention to detail. And, you know, hey, we're talking about correctly marking and taping your fins and your water bottles and alignment of your water bottles, because that's a way for us to check your attention to detail early on versus throwing you under a helicopter or a CV-22 on a hoist where you've got to manage the cable. Like, attention to detail, all those things matter. Sir, you had mentioned, and I think this is good mentorship for folks out there. You talked about, and because this gets a lot of people, you talked about the land nav, and you talked about, hey, there's the wait a minute vines and all that kind of stuff. And you went right through it. Now the other people did dog legs around it and that kind of stuff. So land navigation gets a fair amount of people. Folks out there, don't worry about it. Like, we train you well, but it is still a difficult situation, because especially where we land nav, and I know, you know, a lot of the Rangers, a lot of SF, if they happen to be listening to this, I doubt it. You know, it gets a lot of them too. So,
yeah,
you know, there's a lot of ghost roads, which are roads that you just happen to come across, and you think as you're looking at the map, you're like, okay, that must be this road. It's not. It's not that road. It's a different road. But there's two or three of them before you hit that road. It's weird. That's why pace count is important. All that to say, do you recommend, like, how did that work out for you, just going straight through? And do you recommend that? Because some people, believe it or not, are going to hang their hat on that, and they're going to be in a situation like you were and say, screw it, I'm going through it.
It'll be a personal decision. There is nothing wrong with boxing around it. I was about halfway through the course, and you know, you're tired, you're a bit dehydrated, you're carrying all your possibles on your back, and you just want to get to the very end. And I don't know why I decided just to bust through it. I just probably wasn't the smartest decision. I probably expended more energy butting into that thing than if I'd have just walked around it, which would be a good lesson for everybody listening out there. Take the path of least resistance when you're on a map and compass course, but maintain your situational awareness and remember what your heading and your pace count is, and rely on it. And you'll find the little stick with the magic card on it for your next point to hit.
Yep.
Nice. So, sir, you got through all that. You accomplished those challenges. And I think there's a great metaphor for sometimes you just put your head down, trust yourself, and you just go. That's an amazing piece of mentorship and experience. As you get to your first command, what was it like when you showed up and, you know, to use the term of Pinocchio, you know, you're a real boy. So you had your time as a navigator. I'm ashamed for the pararescueman that couldn't get you over to this side of the fence to bring you over. But, you know, I'll get over it. But now you're a special tactics officer and you take your first teams. What were some challenges that you encountered on that first team, on that first assignment?
Well, it was at Pope, the 21st. And I was the DO. And I was very lucky. You know, throughout my career, I think back different commanders that I've worked for. And a small group of those commanders, the best thing I got from them was I would watch, see what they would do, and decide, I will never do that. It makes no sense. It's kind of stupid. And so it was a negative lesson. But then I had commanders that were very positive teachers. Bob Newman was one of those very positive, very smart, able. And so working for him was good. And I had to get familiar with Manchester Road and the drop zones out there at Bragg. And I would go out and watch what we do. A lot of it was trying to educate myself on it. You could read all the manuals, all the books, but I got out there and I watched the guys do it and how they handled it. And that was probably the easiest way for me to figure it out. I mean, you had some basics in combat control school, but really out there, the light came on, and the guys were good at what they did. And a side note, when I got there, we were known as the Manchester Road Rats because that seemed to be where you spent your whole life. And our own personal training was non-existent. And you know, I talked with Newman. I said, hey, we've got to come up with a way where we have so many people that are slotted against Manchester. We got to have a group that is off in recovery. And we've got to have a group that's in training or personal or combined training, team and combined. And otherwise, when I got there, we had people that hadn't had a parachute jump in a year and a half. Didn't have time. They didn't make time. So we started reorganizing and we held the line on the JATs, they were called, Joint Training.
Yeah.
Airborne something.
Yeah. So basically JAAT. So Joint Airborne. It's essentially, I can't come up with the acronym right now because I've never known this one, but it's essentially a JAT is mutually beneficial training for both the guys that are jumping out and the aircraft that's coming in. And it's like a process, right? Like you send up this request to say, we need to do this jump training. And the air crew says, okay, well, we need to drop people. So we're going to get together and we're going to do this training.
Well, and we had a scheduler, Vicki Hodges, and she was very, very good. And she would go to the JAT conference once a month, and she would load us up with every request people came with. And we had to finally start telling her, no, we're not going to do them all. They're going to have to start moving their stuff together in time and place so that we can use one team instead of six teams to cover this. Because sure. I've got a team that's got to go to training, and I'm not pulling them out of training. Well, she tried to argue that that was good training. I said, well, they've been overtrained in that. They haven't had a parachute jump in a year and a half. We're going to start getting back into our own combat readiness training. And we did that over time. And things got better for the guys. They got a little worn out doing the Manchester Road run. And they needed other things to occupy themselves.
Mm-hmm. So at this time, it's interesting too. You're talking about the precursor to what we do now. And we've talked about the AFSO Forgen and the Jort and all these other things. It's gone to a bunch of different titles, but the whole purpose of these cycles and the way that you're explaining it, hey, individual stuff has to come first, but then we need to get together with teams, and then we need to work with our joint partners, and then we need to get ready to go with a mission. At this time frame, there wasn't exactly a mission on the horizon. There was always, you know, impending instability in the world that you'd have to respond to, but it wasn't, you know, the three of us between Peaches and Trent and I, we were in GWAT. Peaches got in a little bit before 9/11. I got in, you know, right at 9/11, so did Trent. So we always knew that there was this DTAC, this large scale engagement going on, but you didn't. So how important was it for you to really focus and to really keep your team on track with this training when you didn't have something that you were, quote, training for?
Well, it kind of came up and exposed the need. While I was there, the first thing that we got deployed on was hurricane relief at San Croix. And we sent a team down there because we had to run the airfield. Army was coming in, had to, you know, manage the parking spots, all of that. And then I wasn't on it. Bob Newman went. So I got to babysit the home front. And, but they were down there for a pretty good length of time before they came back. Well, they come back and they started finding out weaknesses and things that we had to pay attention to. And shortly after that, the next thing that popped up was Panama going after Noriega. And I was in on that. And all those guys that hadn't jumped for a year and a half, well, we kind of gotten them back up to speed. And we had 20 guys jump in. We were with the 82nd. And but 82nd or Rangers, mass attacks and mass attack, and you've got to see it and live through it. Hopefully,
it is something to behold when you're shotgunning, you know, 200 jumpers, and you know, you get to we had a, you know, sort of an aside, but when, you know, Peaches and I were at the 321st, we would go over and we would jump in the Normandy jumps, and we got to go to the 65th anniversary Normandy jump, and I distinctly remember I'm a static line jumper, I'm in a T10 Delta, straight up crash 10, I look up through the anti inversion netting, and there were 500 jumpers above me. And yeah. I mean, people's helmets were falling off. Like, there was no steering the chute. You know, going to Iron Mike DZ, you're just looking up and you're like, well, this is my fate. And it is absolutely something to behold.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. As a matter of fact, a lesson that we all learned, and I'd say most people on the teams I was with, they on a runway jump, they'll go right down center line and move you out.
Oh, yep.
And all the Rangers, all the Army guys will slip to the infield where it's grass. Well, now I'm looking out, I got 200 people slipping to an infield, and I'm holding over the asphalt because it's safer there. There's not so many people, no entanglements. Oh, and they don't realize, well, you got buildings and antennas and you know, gas pipes, all kinds of stuff on the infield that you can hit. Flat runway. It may be a little firm, but good PLF, and you're fine.
Dynamic PLF, baby. Welcome to ST. Land on that runway. Take your lumps, gentlemen.
That's right. And make sure you've got your helmet strapped down tight. But I'd say on one mass attack, I was already on the ground, and I'm at the PI, the point of impact, and I'm standing there, and more planes are coming in. All of a sudden, there's this thud behind me. You're talking about helmets coming off. I turn around. There's an M60, 10 feet. And, of course, it's screwed up. So I pick it up, and I put it in the back of the Hummer, knowing some trooper's going to come by looking for his gun.
Yes, he is.
We're going to be out here searching for the next week. And but
little hands feet, across America is what we call that one. Get online, everybody. We got something gear adrift. We're going to have to find that bad boy.
Yeah.
Marines 3-6 has entered the chat.
He was so happy when it came up and asked, and I handed it to him. And it had just departed his the 1950, the
weapon case.
Bag, yeah.
The Mossy. And,
That saved us a week of searching. But when that thing hit behind me, I said, even my K-pot is not going to save me on that one. But things are falling out of the sky every time somebody gets under parachute.
Well, it's I'm really glad you brought up Panama, because I think it's we actually haven't had a guest. Correct me if I'm wrong, guys. We haven't had a guest on that was in Just Cause, right?
Yeah. Was it Mike Lampe? Was it somebody told the story? Remember, it was the story about the machine gun, about running down the runway, and he basically ran down the runway in Panama and ran like straight into the machine gun and ended up having to clear that machine gun by himself. Yeah. I don't think it was Mike Lampe. I'm blanking on who that was. I'll figure it out. I'll think about it.
Yeah. What was that like for you? I mean, because you had gone from being a navigator to ST, and then, you know, going through dive school, going through all the training that you did, and then, hey, you're heading to Panama. You're going to do this with 20 of your best friends.
Yeah. It was exciting. And in fact, I got on the plane. And it was a 7-hour flight. They didn't fly straight there. They did a circuitous route, and they dropped in altitude so that the Cubans couldn't pick us up on radar, and then came back up. And we were coming in from the west, and we're down at jump altitude, which remind me to tell you about that. That's different. But we're coming in, and the doors are open, and we're over the water yet. And I'm looking out and I'm going, they're going to call us back. This really isn't going to happen. And then the green light came on. I said, oh, I guess we're really going. And people unasked the plane. And I was years later, I ran into the guy. I was on the lead aircraft in our formation. And I ran into the guy that was the aircraft commander. And we were talking about it. And I said, well, yeah, they dropped us at 500 feet. That makes you think, but your reserve, if you're quick enough, may help resolve something. And he looked at me and says, you weren't at 500 feet. We had to drop to 400 feet.
Oh my God. Get out of here. Why even have the reserve? The reserve at that point is just extra weight. Just either your chute's going to open or it's not.
You know what? I think the decision was made, not just from us, the whole task force, go with the reserve because it'll give you more confidence. And instead of thinking, I only got one parachute. And
what a ridiculous thing. It'll give you more confidence. Oh, okay, tight. Yeah, great.
I mean, I guess if you land in a tree, it gives you a little extra, you know, you can climb your way down. But sure. 400 feet.
I'll tell you, when I jumped out, and it was a short trip to the ground, checking around me, and we're in this elephant grass. It's 12 feet high. And I was figuring, okay, first thing I did was I was checking my chute, and it was still opening. And when I saw that it opened up and I had a good chute, and I stopped worrying about that and started looking to see if I needed to drop my rucksack or not. And I ended up landing with it on because I was coming down in this black hole, and I couldn't tell what was there until I started descending at about 12 feet. I saw what I was in, and I landed, and then I disconnected my rucksack. I didn't know if it was trees or what, so
yeah,
rode it on in, and things like that are chaos and confusing, and all you can do is think your way through it. One of the best pieces of advice I ever got, when you're in the middle of something and everything's going crazy and you got to make a determination on what you're going to do, and you've got people around you that are spinning up into the ceiling, so take 5 seconds, analyze what's happening, figure out what you can do about it, and then act. Take 5 seconds. A lot of people won't take 5 seconds. They'll just react. And it may or may not be the best thing. And saves you a lot of heartache and rework. Do it right the first time, you're better off.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of lessons learned just in that one, you know, 45 second clip that you just made for us. So appreciate that. But
that's what we call a reel that's going to bang, sir.
Yeah. But I think it's important to, and this isn't going to be necessarily a question, but what you're saying, like, there's a lot of chaos going on at that time, you know, and that's probably not the only time you ever felt chaos. You can feel chaos in operations, training, and that kind of stuff. But being able to respond to that chaos appropriately and at the right level of maybe stress or anxiety is important. And I think, like, going back to what the pipeline is now and the whole point of the pipeline, you know, Indoc used to be, hey, we're going to select you, but we're going to select you, but also prepare you for scuba school. You know, everybody's familiar with what the pipeline is now, but we need to stress inoculate every single person that is going to go into Air Force Special Warfare so that when it is that chaos, whether it's training or real world, you know, operations, or just, you know, on your trip to the grocery store kind of thing, that you are able to remain cool, calm, and collected and have that mental bandwidth to be able to make good decisions and not freeze or not make kind of a hasty decision. So, like I said, more of a comment than a question, but if you had anything to add on it, please pile in on it.
Well, like I said, taking 5 seconds and reflecting is a good idea. I think back on a book I read. I think the guy's name was Miller, retired Army 3-star. He led the battalion that was the first helicopter assault in Vietnam. Been through training, and they did it. And they got locked down by stiff resistance. And one of the things he wrote about in his book is figure out what's happening to you, determine whether you can affect that and take that action. Then there are going to be things that you can't affect. And what you need to do is call higher and say, hey, I need air cover. I need artillery, whatever it is that you need to battle that, because there's some things that are going to be outside your reach. Don't worry about them. Let somebody else worry about them and help solve them. But what you can affect that's right in front of you, work on that.
Yeah.
The name of the book was Iatrang.
I mean, and that's good. You know, that guy had a lot of experience, and it just made me think. Aaron had brought up that we all were in GWAT, like, our entire careers, right? So, like, my entire experience training home station is people coming back from overseas and telling us why everything is important, right? There's that certain expectation of what you're going to get yourself into. So as you guys are training up in between these, like, you know, little skirmishes that are happening all over the world, what were the stories that, like, people were saying? Like, what was the experience that was being fed into you to take the training seriously, to make sure that guys were ready for what, when a Panama kicks off, or, you know, Desert Storm, or, you know, GWAT, you know? So, like,
yeah, even a hurricane, like, even, you know, right, trying to go and answer a humanitarian rescue, like, those. Yeah. Great, great question, Trent. That's a good one.
Yeah.
I guess, especially 2-4, guys would come back and they would carry that back down the team rooms, because not everybody went on a particular operation. And it would be our informal debrief. And it could cover anything on the best way to wear your uniform. You know, your BDUs. You got your pants, you got blouse over it, blouse, boots, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of guys started tucking their blouse in inside the belt, because you go through a magazine, you don't want to throw it away, so it goes right down the shirt, and it's there for when you get resupplied. Small thing, but important, because you get resupplied, you don't have a magazine. That single bullet every time is not going to hack it. For the controllers, it came down to how well you know that radio. Can you troubleshoot it? Can you solve the problem with it? You've got a backup, but take 5 seconds. What's the problem? And if you can fix it, good. You've still got a backup. If you can't, now you're down to one and you're carrying dead weight back to the radio repairman. So for the pararescuemen, one of the things I remember came out, we designed a new rucksack, medical rucksack. And it was hefty. It had mask pants in it, had all the different gauze, bandages, morphine, everything PJ would need. And it was kind of rectangular. And you could unzip the whole thing around it, and it would lay open. And God, I can see the guy's face. The guy that kind of came up with the design.
Was it Dave Cruz?
Who?
Dave Cruz.
No.
He very famously had a ruck. We, no kidding, the Med Gear was in a Dave Cruz ruck for the longest time. Like when I was a very young PJ, they were like, hey, make sure, like, PJ, you got the Dave Cruz pack. Yeah. Like that, like, no kidding. He was the guy that like made the pack that we all had. So we called it. And it's funny that you bring up these TTPs that live on and become, no kidding, like these things are forged in blood. One of the biggest things that came out of Operation Gothic Serpent or Black Hawk Down, as everybody's known, Tim Wilkinson was famous because he came back from that operation. He had like a full med ruck, and people were like, how do you still have equipment left? He's like, oh, I didn't use my own med ruck. I took medical gear off of everybody else. Yeah. He was like, that's how you do it. That's no kidding where IFACS came from. Like when we started having gear for medics to use on other people, Tim Wilkinson, that was one of the biggest takeaways. He's like, he was laughing about it. He was like, oh, I didn't take any gear out of my own ruck. I stole gear from everybody. But that's one of those things where unless you pass that knowledge on, unless you tell those young folks and the guys in the team room, hey, this worked, this didn't, here's what we need to do. Like the fact that you guys engineered a way to keep your mags for resupply, that's just, it was born of necessity, but it's such an intuitive thing that you just figured out. You figured out on your own. And those lessons are so important.
Yeah. It was kind of informal. We had an after action report sequence. We'd write those up. We do a debrief squadron wide. And I had one of the admin specialists keeping track, because in the lessons learned, things would come up like, oh, we need a new medical ruck. We need a different set of boots for shipboard ops. We need on and on. Well, before me, okay, it got filed away, and it stayed filed away until it got written up again. Yeah. Then they filed it away. And I said, this is crazy. We're relearning the same thing. So I had a running list of after action report necessities, boots, rucksacks, whatever. And they were briefed every week. And I would see, okay, has this been, is there a solution? Where are we with it? We're waiting delivery. Okay. So we started hacking away at those lessons learned and actually doing something about it. But what I found, especially if you're a commander, whatever you get briefed on each week becomes important to all the rest of the troops. If you're briefed on the CFC, Combined Federal Campaign, that's going to be important. If you're briefed on after action necessities, that's going to become important, and they'll focus on it. So actually, it wasn't so much for my benefit. I wanted them to see it. So they go, whoa, okay. He's interested in this. He tracks it weekly. And it helped me.
Controlling the narrative from the command position. I love that. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Well, and throughout this time, y'all went through, you know, multiple, I think, you know, like jungle events and then desert events and all these other things. Like, how did you keep track of that? And then as time went on, you know, we ended up in the desert multiple times. Mm. Like, how many of these things like carried over, and how hard was that transition for y'all? Because I know we took a lot of flack during GWAT, still doing a lot of like jungle and water training. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that is based on that, just like that DNA that we got from y'all, you know, like that, you got to be ready just in case you got to go back to Panama type of situation. But also, you know, you switch environments real quick. You know, you go from, you know, Panama to Desert Storm or wherever it was that you went next. It's a big change in environment with a whole new list of things that you need to be concerned about. And, you know, the AR that list of items is going to change pretty drastically, I'd imagine.
Yeah, it. If we were going somewhere where we weren't familiar with what to expect, and this was especially 2-4, we had our contacts with the Army and the Navy, and we could call them and say, hey, you guys, what are the issues? What should we be looking for? And they would share information. So it doesn't have to stay just within your group or your career field. We would branch out. When we were at the 2-4, the guys had three different A3 bags with equipment. And one was if you were going with the Navy, one was if you were going with the SF, and one was for going with the Rangers. And they were all different. And there were some commonality, but we knew who was going and kind of who was going to be with which unit. They grab that A3 bag and go. And from a lesson learned, instead of trying to carry one humongous bag, tailor it for their TTPs. And so you can dress the way they dress. I mean, guys, and like the Army unit would change all the time. But we had guys with just sterilized uniforms and a soft cap. Go with the Navy, we had uniforms, but the Navy preferred that we wore Navy rank. You're aboard ship, you got regular Navy, on and on. So we had in that kit bag, we had Navy rank on the uniforms. So those are small things, but you talk across services and figure out the best way to survive.
With the Rangers, they all had razors and hair clippers, I'm assuming, so you could blend in with the...
You better believe it. Their headquarters company carried it with them. They were using them.
Oh, man, I don't know if I've ever said this on the podcast, but I had an encounter with a Ranger captain at the very beginning of OEF. We have to link up, but that's weird. Happened to run into each other in the showers, right? And like that was bad. Poor choice.
Careful, careful.
Yeah. Anyway, I had a beard, right? And the captain stops me. It's like, hey, I think you're forgetting something, you know. And it was a full on knife hand. And I was like, no, I think I'm good. He's like, I think you forgot to shave today. I'm like, I've got a full on beard. It's not like I just missed a day of shaving. Like, I've got a full on beard. And he's like, you are not leaving this shower without shaving. It's like, well, I am, because I don't work for you. I'm not a Ranger. And I'm a E4 senior airman. And you know, I got a captain telling me. So I was like, well, I'm not shaving. So we got to figure this out.
So here we are.
Yeah. And so he marches me down to the 06 that's in charge of Air Force elements and wakes him up out of crew rest to go, hey, I got one of your guys. Sorry, sir, but I got one of your guys that is deciding not to shave. And he basically is like, Peaches, you can go on about your business. I got to handle this real quick. I presume he laid into that guy, because not only did he had no business, you know, trying to get me to shave, but at the same time, he interrupted crew rest when we were doing operations. So, yeah, I was getting filthy looks from that captain for the rest of the rotation. So it was good, but, no, that's great, sir. And, real quick, kind of before we kind of wrap things up, I'm not sure how familiar you are with the new pipeline and stuff like that, but our demographic right now is right around 15 to 25 year olds. We do have some younger and some older folks, but like that's kind of the main folks that our analytics tell us are watching and listening. What kind of advice?
You said 15 to 25 year olds. You getting 15 yep. year olds in? Really?
Well, they're watching. Yeah. Because they're starting to, even though they're.
Okay. I thought you meant into the pipeline.
No. No.
Okay. They're watching. Okay.
They're watching, listening. Excuse me. Boy, that's really bad. I need to bleep that out. Yeah. Whoops. It happens. Mark that time.
Got it. Marked.
So, you know, what kind of advice would you give to those folks before or as they're in? I'll just kind of open it up, you know, whether they're in preparation or, you know, whether they're the first team or it's their fourth assignment within Special Tactics or Air Force Special Warfare.
You got to prepare your mind and your body. Most everybody has an idea of how to prepare the body. There's a lot of different exercise routines and whatnot, depending on what you want to do and how you sequence it, on and on. Preparing the mind. Actually, what I've come down to is the best thing you can do is read books. Actually, what they found is reading regularly will actually increase your IQ. It'll make you mentally more nimble, or train you to be more nimble. It'll give you examples that you can say, oh, I like that. I want to incorporate that into the way I do things. So now, of course, it's going to matter what kind of book you read. I don't know if I can go into this, but I'm thinking some of the stuff around today on may not be what I'm talking about.
You're right. You can't go into that. And we're going to do you solid and we're going to cut that one out.
Yeah. We're going to help you out and not put that in there.
Okay. We're going to bleep one word out of there because it was only the one word. And really, other than that, it was a great input. So we're just going to go from there and people will just have to guess.
Okay. If you're reading social commentary type stuff, it's maybe not so helpful.
Social commentary type stuff. Exactly. Yeah. If you're reading books on indoctrination of ideologies that are not going to support what we're trying to do here in America, you are darn right. Yeah.
But I like, so what books would you recommend then? Because we do get that question. We have a reading list on our website.
Well, I'm just right off the top of my head. Iatran Valley was one. I got one. And if you get one good idea out of every book you read, pretty soon you got a cluster of good ideas. In the Devil's Shadow by Mike Hawes. He was.
It's a great book. It's a great book.
It is. Very eye-opening. And deals with Air Force Special Operations in the Korean theater, and not as you think of special ops right now, but something very much more clandestine. But good read.
It started special activities. People don't realize how Air Force Special Tactics got into special activities, but it was during the Korean War. Some call it the Forgotten War, but that's where the special activities really stepped up on the Air Force side was the Korean War.
Yeah. There's a group of them that came out through Air University Press, Apollo's Warriors, kind of a history of AFSOC, ground and air. There's another one. I think the author was Colonel Thigpen. Had mainly to do with the MC-130. But there's going to be little things in each of them that will help. I guess read more along a professional vein as far as novels, they can help, but history is good. And if you really want to, you could read after action reports.
Yeah. But, I mean, some of them are published. A lot of the ones from, I guess. Time-wise, now we are coming close to some of those early operations in Afghanistan and stuff becoming unclassified and being published. But yeah, those are good. Those are real good lessons learned in a lot of those.
What a wild thing that I So it takes 25 years to get documents declassified. And you just said that some of the early GWAT stuff is about to get declassified. That just blew my mind. That's been 21 years since that kicked off. That's a crazy thing to try to wrap my specific head around, but that's just because I'm stupid. Wow.
Read more books, Aaron.
Yep.
Yeah. That's facts.
Yeah, for sure. Well, sir, really appreciate you joining us. Thanks for the conversation. It was really good conversation. Again, I don't think you and I had ever met, but I had heard about you, you know, coming through the pipeline and once I graduated and that kind of stuff. So, thanks for everything that you did for Special Tactics, the Air Force and our nation. And man, all the gratitude I could possibly give you, like, thank you. And then to everybody else out there, you got anything to answer? I'm sorry. I kind of cut you off.
I just wanted to thank you guys for the invite. It was good seeing you on my computer. And I want to reemphasize, I think this podcast, as far as getting information out, recording history, making it available to the 15 to 25 year olds that are thinking about coming in, little secrets on how they can prepare, is really a step in the right direction for the whole the group of career fields. So thank you guys.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate it. Appreciate the support and the kind words. And for everybody that's out there, please, you know, subscribe, hit the notification bell, leave us a review, all that kind of good stuff. And then we're out here. Thank you. Have a good one.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you. Later, y'all. Train hard.